Turan, maybe some words. Let's invoke some words of blessing and presence. I'd like to invite someone to do that today. And I'd like to see your faces while I'm saying that. Why not, my dear Hari Vyasadev? Yes.
I knew it.
You knew it, so.
I knew it. Nice to see you, Maharaj. Thank you for the opportunity. Well, may this gathering in the Tadatmya village may it increase our trust in each other and in the divine, the sweet absolute, and may it help us go deeper inward and see that the divine is very close, closer than our own breath, that it's inside and outside. May our questions be answered, or may even better questions arise.
Gaur Haribol. Thank you. So now we are finally ready to go. I didn't feel sure safe enough, but now Arabiya set the stage, and thank you. We appreciate those words. So pranam to all. Greetings from New Zealand this time. I'm officially New Zealand, bodily speaking. On a psychic level, I'm somewhere across the ocean still. So, still arriving after just one day and 2 days of traveling, and yeah, jet lag and change of time zones. But I'm happy that somehow or other Nidra Devi, the goddess of sweet sleep, allowed me to have some relatively normal timing of rest for me to be able to connect today in my morning here. Again, for most of you, it's night, evening, afternoon, but as you may know, here, people in New Zealand live in the future, so it's the morning of Sunday. So if you want to know the future, just ask us and we'll let you know what will be happening. So yeah, glad to be here. Sorry not to been able to connect for the last 3 weeks, but as you know, we were quite immersed in our Navadvip pilgrimage with some of you who are connected here and some of you who are not able to be present, but somehow or other were there with all of us in spirit. So still processing the thickness of that pilgrimage, lots of layers to integrate. And what best way to do it that among pilgrims like all of us. So thank you for joining us in today's pilgrimage. And as usual, the invitation is to bring anything to the table. If you have a quest, question that sets you on a quest, and you would like to present it today. Any themes, any points in the infinite line of reality that you would like to focus for a moment, or for more than a moment, whatever you need to bring. Like I was talking recently with a Vaishnavi in Mayapur, and she told me that she has with a group of friends at conversations that are called taboo talks, right? Like a way of opening the door to speak about all the things that in certain circles you are not supposed to ask or even allowed to ask. So taboo talks are welcome to the table as well. I mean, that's already happening for a few years, but just in case I'm making it more official. And as usual, those who have anything to share publicly today would like to bring, you can raise your digital hand, as I'm seeing a few of you are already doing. So we'll start with it says Vincent and Jennifer. I'm saying only Jennifer, but I know Vincent is somewhere nearby, probably with Nimai from the Netherlands. So please invite Jennifer to unmute yourself. Welcome.
Yeah, Hare Krishna to all of you. Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare
Yeah,
Krishna.
nice to be back in the Sangha. Yeah, I'm reading at the moment Radical Personalism. And in the chapter about non-duality from the page 193, there is on yeah, I have a question about one sentence, and I will read it, and then I will ask my question. So it's on page 195. You write, "Therefore, we need to train our minds in non-dual thinking. That training is in itself a way of thinking because it involves a non-dual lifestyle and not a mere theological stance." And then, because I'm always such a practical-oriented person, I was thinking like, okay, therefore we need to train our minds in non-dual thinking. And then I tried to picture myself, for example, because we have a son of 2 years, I was seeing myself on the playground, for example, and then I thought like, how can I practice in this moment, for example, it's just one example out of my life that I live, non-dual thinking. And I could not come up with it is so difficult. The topic in general is very difficult for me to understand, non-duality. It's yeah, it's quite abstract. And yeah, I was just thinking if you could give some yeah examples, how could I or we train non-dual thinking on a yeah on a daily basis.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So non-dual thinking. And of course I personally welcome Vincent. Nice to see you. So I personally felt the need at the time, and I still feel the need, and at that time when writing the book, I mean, to make a whole chapter on non-dual thinking, because I know it's not an expression that we often entertain in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, that sometimes it's kind of dismissed or downplay, like something that we don't have anything to do with that. We're not non-dualists. We are devotional people, yeah, but we are devotional non-dualists, right? Since Bhagavatam, our main book, and many other scriptures, Bhagavad Gita itself, they describe reality as being non-dual. And by non-dual, again, just to clarify this before officially going to your question, by non-dual, we are speaking about unified wholeness, like reality, whatever exists. Is interconnected, intertwined, interrelated. There is a common center around which things revolve. And of course, when we are not aware of that, then we live life dualistically, which is a problem because reality is non-dual, right? So dualism means seeing things existing in isolation, right? And I think we can all relate to that when we see ourselves or see other people or see circumstance, and sometimes we tend to compartmentalize people, situations, ideas, like this has nothing to do with that, he doesn't have anything to do with she, this is like existing in its own bubble. Well, from the bigger picture, and that may require for us to zoom out and see in the bigger picture, everything exists, it's contained into a same one same vessel, revolve around one same center. And the center, and again, sorry if all this sounds like too much abstraction, but I think it's important to say some of these words. Like Srila Siddharth Maharaj will quote a Western mystic also. He will say, the center, we speak about Krishna, the divine, the sweet absolute Mahaprabhu as the center. So generally, when we think about the center, right, we think, well, there is the center, and then there is the circumference around the center, and then you have the circle. But he will say the center is everywhere, right? And the circumference is nowhere. So it's difficult to figure out, because for us, the center in our mind is, okay, this is the center, and there are the. And of course, we speak about us revolving around the center, but at the same time, the center is everywhere. It's an omnipresent center. So, going to your question, trying to bring all this abstract philosophy to practicality, especially as you were giving your example, okay, being a mother of a 2-year-old boy, how to You can even write a whole book about it, right? Practicing non-duality with a 2-year-old boy. Like, if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere, right? And it's a great challenge. It's beautiful. It's not like, oh no, I'm a mother, I have a 2-year-old boy. Non-duality has nothing to do with me at this stage of my life. No, the challenge is how to see it, right? So maybe one can begin again, and especially one is more practically minded oriented, so to say. Each one of us have a different lenses and natures to approach reality, and it's totally fine. So maybe starting with perception, right? Rather than philosophy, no? Like, non-dual thinking starts, let's put it this way. And again, it's practical and it's challenging. It's not just I do that and it's working, but non-dual thinking may start by slowing down the moment of perception, right? And what do I mean by this? Like, instead of assuming this is good, this is bad, no, this is me, this is not me, this is you, this is not you, or whatever, trying to gradually train our minds by paying attention, by noticing how the mind is dividing reality constantly. Again, as I said, putting things into boxes, compartmentalizing. I like it, I don't like it. No? So it's all about bringing awareness into everyday life, into every single moment. And that's a training. Again, it starts with hearing about that for the first time, maybe hopefully feeling some inner confirmation, yes, that happens. Yes, I know that's something that I feel the call to work on, and then trying to bring that into the daily life. No? And when you notice it, I don't know, a judgment, and I'm not talking to you only, Jennifer. I mean, this, we are all welcome to the club, we are all in it. So when we notice a judgment arising in our minds, maybe noticing, okay, here's the mind dividing. No? Here's the mind trying to putting things into boxes and to feel a greater sense. And again, not with resentment, right? Not like with feeling this mind is such a bad guy inside my head or whatever. But trying to see it even with compassion, right? Like, okay, this is a survival mechanism. The mind tries to divide things because by dividing and putting things in boxes, it gives a sense of order. And by giving a sense of order, it gives a sense of security and a sense of safety. And all that is a survival mechanism, which is fine. I mean, we all need some safety and security. The thing is that sometimes we end up looking for that in ways that become like exaggerated in terms of how we try to put everything into boxes. And we end up dividing, instead of you ultimately realizing the order that I need to bring me the ultimate safety and security is an order where everything belongs, quoting Father Richard Rohr, right? So trying even not only to acknowledge the mind dividing, but when we notice that, again, not like judging ourselves in a cruel way or condemning the mind for, because that's another way of further dividing the whole thing. Right. So, because one may think, okay, to develop non-dual thinking, notice your mind dividing. And when that happens, you insult your mind and you start to, this mind is, or I'm such a bad person. And then you're promoting further divisiveness. So we are still falling to the same trap. Now that creates like small inner gap still. No? So trying to bridge the gap. But even when we witness divisiveness, putting things into boxes, doing it compassionately. Whenever the mind is kind of splitting reality into binaries, right? Into this and that again. And again, as I try to make it clear in my book, there's nothing wrong with dualistic thinking at some level and at some stage of our life. We need to think, okay, this is good, this is bad, this or this is that. But at one point, that way of seeing reality is not whole enough, wholesome enough. So we need to invoke a bigger picture. And in that bigger picture, we can still categorize things, knowing all this is held into a bigger picture. But gradually, and I would say that's the purpose of every sadhaka or practitioner, that's the idea to awaken to that bigger picture. Even when we speak about black and white, happy and sad, good and bad, it's all existing not unto itself in their own separate categories, but it's held into, again, bigger non-dual reality. So, yeah, trying to name the things, right? Trying not to suppress, for example, going to practicality. If we witness ourselves, again, having the mind split in reality into black and white, so to say, happy and sad, good and bad, this or that, trying to name the things, again, compassionately, and holding them in awareness at the same time. Naming it, okay, I feel attraction, I feel fear, or I don't know, I want intimacy, I want closeness, and I want space and distance, or this is beautiful, and it is impermanent at the same time. Or this person inspires me, and they trigger me at the same time. It's paradoxical, right? But all that can happen. And just voicing that compassionately, not again with judgment, not with hatred, with resentment, with bitterness, but being able to voice that allows us to acknowledge that reality, but to hold that in a bigger space, again, compassionate space. And again, not and trying to reconcile apparent opposites and being at peace with dealing with that. Like both are true. Okay, as I say, this is beautiful and it is impermanent. One doesn't cancel the other necessarily, right? Both are true. So how to hold what in the beginning may sound like contradictory or opposites. I also speak about that in Radical Personalism, and I'm so sure in which chapter, about the Latin concept of coincidentia oppositorum, which how the divine is the coincidence of opposites, interestingly. So we are approaching the infinite, and in the infinite, what looks like an opposite from our perspective is perfectly reconciled in the absolute. So how to gradually allow ourselves to do things, because again, for most of us, the mind is trained without any conscious training to split reality again in binaries and then to pick one or the other. Now, acceptance and rejection. Instead of seeing both, accepting both compassionately and seeing a bigger picture in which these things are happening. So like, I don't know, going to your 2-year-old, okay, I love this boy, and sometimes this boy makes me crazy. Hopefully not, but I can imagine it can happen, especially a 2-year-old. I've heard a 2-year-old is an intense age. I have to ask my mom about that. I don't remember much, but anyhow. So, and you don't need to deny any of both, right? It's not like because my Nimai makes me crazy, then I don't love this boy. No. And it does that because I love this boy, oh, then he cannot make me crazy. Yeah, both of them ex and again, it seems like how could they possibly exist at the same time? I'm sure you have a very visceral experience of both happening at the same time. So a way of training our minds in non-dual thinking is just accepting both, right? And not labeling them. One is the good and the other is the bad. No, it's all part of what it means to be a mother, let's say. No, so that will be a non-dual reconciliation, to give an example. You still love that person, and you don't need to cancel the fact that sometimes he drives you mad. And again, that driving you mad is not his bad intention toward you or anything. It's just what naturally happens in the context of having a relationship. Like probably Vincent also drives you mad at times. Not only your 2-year-old boy, but your 50-year-old boy or whatever. And vice versa, no? Not to put Jennifer in the position of a victim, so to say, right? We all drive each other crazy sometimes without bad intentions, just life happens, right? So try to invoke this acceptance, right? Like It is what it is. No, I cannot change it. I cannot force my 2-year-old boy to behave like a perfect wise elder of 75. So it is what it is, and it's beautiful in its own way, paradoxically. No? So trying to so paradox is an important word in this connection, and that's why in our philosophical system, the name of our philosophy is Achintya Bheda Veda Tattva, and Achintya could be translated as paradoxical. So reality is paradoxically one and different, which is again very much an invitation to enter into this non-duality. There's unity and there is difference. There is I love this boy and he drives me crazy, so to say. And all of that is Achintya, is paradoxical. No? It's not contradictory. It seems contradictory. But paradox means something that holds greater truth. No? We have to have this, even if you can remind yourself about that, like reality is large enough to hold this, whatever this may be. No? If I'm confronted with a situation that I find it this clashing of opposites, reminding myself, reality is large enough to accommodate all this, to hold this. Reality is ultimately non-dual. So that gives space for everything. Everything exists in relationship, in connection to something else. So everything holds a purpose. I may not be seeing that, and I may have to be patient, or as I say before, we may need to slow down to understand what we cannot understand when we are going too fast. To see what we cannot see when we are going too fast. And I know that's enough of a challenge for the lifestyle most of us have in the present time and age, which everything goes faster and faster. And as we know, the faster we go, the less we can pay attention to things that we will see only if we slow down. So slowing down in itself allows for greater capacity of witnessing and understanding and listening and seeing what otherwise will not be perceivable from us for us. So, I don't know, some thoughts that are coming now, but you tell me if you need some further examples or something that may help.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Maharaj. Yeah, for me it helped a lot to have some examples, and now I just had the thought that at the same time I think Nimai, our little son, our 2-year-old son, he can also be a big teacher of non-duality, because sometimes then when I think like, oh, it's raining and this and that, he points out to a flower, and I think like, oh yeah, he said, look, mama, a flower, and it's
Oh yeah.
he shows the beauty, and yeah, so. It's also
Yeah.
good to remember that yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I will something that comes to my mind is that also like again, I'm talking not from personal experience of being a father in this lifetime biologically, but what I've seen is like and how nature is how they society that nature is designed in such a way purposefully is like in one sense one's child is a mirror of the present moment, so to say, right? So that's hard because it's difficult to be with a mirror 24/7. But in one sense the child, especially the age of the Nimai, they live in one sense they live in a in something that we may describe as a type of non-dual state compared to our how the child's brain works is quite preconceptual. The child is not thinking in too much concepts and compartmentalizing things so much as we adults do. So they do are not dividing the world as much as we do yet. So they live more in the immediate experience. So in one sense, that's a big you have there a big non-dual guru right in front of you. And sometimes we may be exhausted exactly before because they are teaching us the thing that we the lesson that we have forgotten, so to say, or that we are not right. Or the child is very curious, right? Again, in that immediacy, in the present moment, curious exploration, and we adults sometimes have lost that sense of curiosity and awe and wonder, and more again, judgmental, controlling, putting things into boxes. So, in many ways, a child like of that age is very much inviting to embrace non-duality, to embrace all these spirit that receives reality for what it is in the present moment, in the immediate moment, right? And again, it can be exhausting because we may not have that muscle quite trained, and then comes dealing with that, as I say before, with acceptance, and that's a form of non-duality. Okay, my child needs attention and I need rest. Both. How to solve that riddle, that's another conversation, but holding both, right? Not dismissing one at the cost of the other. I feel grateful again, and I feel exhausted. I love my child deeply and I want space. At least acknowledging those internally, accepting both, not feeling in the pressure of, no, I just, even if in practice I still have to pay more attention to one, integrating both, it's a form of non-duality, of allowing apparent contradictions to coexist, and gradually that becomes more and more of a realization. So anyhow, some further thoughts that came, but thank you for asking that. I trust it can help many of us to deal in daily life, not only as parents, but also especially as parents. Yeah, very important question. Non-dual parenthood. There you have the title for the book. I'm sure many parents will be blessed by that. Thank you. Let's go to our breakthrough rooms before raise hands of Kanupriya and John. And let's share a few thoughts, whether you are a father, a mother, a swami, or a single one. I trust that for each of us, something, hopefully some chord string has been touched inside in terms of embracing non-duality in the practical, concrete daily life, and how to express that and integrate that even in what we may label as the most ordinary moments of my daily life. So for a few minutes, Bhakti Rasa will invite us to what we call breakout breakthrough rooms for a few minutes, sharing whatever comes in your heart in this connection about, I will say, trying to make it personal, so something from your own experience in this connection. And we'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back. So, welcome back. I hope you had a nice interaction. Going back to childlike experiences. So Rig Veda said, because we have this, there's one mic on back to Rasa, or more than one, I don't know. The Bible says, right? Jesus says in the Bible, only those who are like children can enter into the kingdom of God. But also, I recently discovered that also the Rig Veda, which is a very, arguably the most ancient Vedic text, basically says the exact same thing. Like, only if you become children, not childish, but childlike, you can, that's the way to enter, basically. That's the entry ticket. So those who have a child literally in front of them on a daily basis, that's a powerful, beautiful reminder of what we are supposed to embrace, right? As much as a father has to teach their children, and there is so much to be taught by them, no? So that's always a healthy pattern. Guru is teaching the disciple, but a real guru will be also learning so much. Now, the more advanced you are, the more capacity to learn you have. So yeah, that's how the universal order is maintained, always reciprocal. Let's go to the next raised digital hand, which was Kanupriya from Germany. Invited to unmute yourself.
Hare Krishna. Today I have a curious question. It's not about so much about me, but so this week the message spread in the social media about this deity which was found, or two deities which were found in Mayapur. I don't know if I have to repeat the story or if everybody knows about this.
You can mention it briefly.
Okay, so I think it was last week. There was one Prabhu, I think he's living in Mayapur, and he had a dream, and in his dream he saw a saintly person, a woman, and there was apparently another Prabhu in the same room, and he in the morning he said, during the night you recited a poem or a song, and I recorded it, and it was the content of this poem was, there is a deity hidden in some lake where Mahaprabhu bathed, and so on. It was described where it is. And so the next morning, he and his friends, they went searching for this deity, and by some, also in a miraculous way, they found it. And and it seems that Jananivas and other authorities approved that it's a very old deity of Prodamaya. And it is said that, as I understood, it was even predicted that this deity will appear, and then when this deity appears, Mayapur will again flourish. And this was more or less this. And they started to worship the deity. I think it was Jananivas who said a temple should be built for this deity. And okay, so I think this was more or less the message which was spread. And it touched me a lot because we have been at this place where the deity was found 6 days before, I still remember very deeply this place. It's near the place of Kulavecha Shrida. It's a forest of mango trees out in the middle of nowhere, and somewhere there the deity was found in a box. So as I said, I'm just curious to hear more about this deity, Prodamaya, the it's why she's so important for us, for Mayapur, and can you say more about this prediction, and so on and so on. Whatever you know about this, I would like to hear from you.
Can you hear me? Yes. Yeah, the microphone is on. Yeah. So, well, thank you for the question to begin with. Yeah, you shared with us a few days ago. Maybe if some of you were aware, some of you were not aware of this particular incident that took place some days ago, which of course, yeah, following all the detailed description of what happened, it sounds quite miraculous. Of course, some people will say, okay, miracles do not exist, and actually it's God's acting at every moment, and miracle is just, I mean, if you want to call that a miracle, then everything is a miracle. Or miracle is like something beyond our normal capacity of operating. I have no problem calling it whatever it is, but yeah, it's very interesting how it manifested. One, before going to Prodamaya, two things that come into mind, of course, regarding the flourishing of Mayapur. I'm curious also, I mean, of course, that will be something to ask probably some of the devotees who had the direct experience, but what's the idea of flourishing of Mayapur also? Right, because sometimes again that may be very relative to each person's own notions. Some may think, okay, more people will come, or some will think not necessarily more people will come, but there will be a deepening in whatever Mayapur is, a flourishing of our appreciation of Gaur Tattva. You follow my point, right? Because sometimes flourishing of Mayapur may think, okay, the whole planet Earth will surrender to Mahaprabhu, where we will finally take over the world, and probably that's not the flourishing of Mayapur, and it's okay, right? Things like that. I have nothing against the flourishing of Mayapur. Of course, in a deeper sense, Mayapur is always flourishing, and And Navadvip is always flourishing. It's Nava. Dvip, Nava means also new. So it's always in a new or ever new way, expanding and growing. Even if in the outer state it's not, it may not appear to be the case for some. But also something that when I heard the story, again, as much as I totally appreciate it and I have nothing in terms of doubts, like, okay, no, I'm not sure if that's a made-up story or stuff. I'm not thinking like that. But when it was mentioned, okay, that's coincides with the like the relatively future inauguration of ISKCON's Temple of Vedic Planetariums, that's the name. And I have nothing against that either, but it felt a little bit on a subtle way like institutionalizing the miracle, so to say. Like trying to connect something deep and mystical with a particular inauguration of a particular temple in a particular, I mean, I'm not saying that whomever said that is thinking like that, but that's how I felt it, and a few others that I talked to as well. So it felt like a subtle way of canvassing, like, okay, the actual flourishing of Mayapur is connected to what my particular group is doing, so to say. I'm not saying that's the original intention, but and if again, if the actual flourishing of Mayapur has to happen for a particular group, again, I have nothing against that as long as we do not become overtly institutionalizing in terms of that. Now, because Krishna's grace can flow in so many ways, and if it flows through a particular channel, we all celebrate that as long as the channel acknowledges that it's being a channel and not that it has all the rights and copyrights for God's grace, and only through this it flows mostly like that, right? So I want to clarify that because, yeah, I personally felt a little unsettled by the. It was almost the conclusive part, like the whole story converging to, and this coincides with the future inauguration of this. So, like, kind of trying to put all of these things like an absolute parallel, and it may be the case, it may not be the case, I don't know. And connection to Prodamaya. So Prodamaya is basically, let's put it this way, Yogamaya's version in Gaur Lila. So as we have Yogamaya in Krishna Lila, this particular energy which is in the Lila appears personified in the figure of Purnamasi, this elderly lady, ascetic, that somehow is the guru of Vrindavan. No? In practical terms, the Brajavasis see Purnamasi as their gurvi. No? Gurvi will be the female for guru, right? And they go and consult her and pray to her and ask for advice. And somehow she's orchestrating, helping to make arrangements, like facilitator for the Leela to unfold and to happen. It's a particular function of the Swarup Shakti, we'll say, a particular function of the inner potency that facilitates, accommodates, unfolds, expands the stage of love for love to reach a new level. So as much as we talked in our Navadvipa Parikram about the non-difference between Krishna and Mahaprabhu, Gaur Lila and Krishna Lila, then we can make a similar case for Yogamaya and Prodamaya. No? And Prodamaya in this case being Yogamaya acting in Gaur Lila and expanding and extending certain influence, especially in Gaur Lila again, which requires so much accommodation because this is a very interesting Lila in which Krishna is in a very interesting mood, trying to experience a very interesting set of things that require considerable stretching and accommodation for God to forget, not only forget that he's God, because that's already happening in Krishna Lila, right? Krishna Lila, Krishna God is not aware that he's God. So Yogamaya is doing her part nicely there. Now in Gaur Lila, Krishna, who is God, who forgot that he's God, now wants to forget that he's Krishna. And he wants to become fully aware of Radha's bhav. So that requires another layer of accommodation, spaciousness, unfolding, a new stage for that lila to take place. So we will say that Prodamaya is that facilitator, which for me it's a very beautiful way of thinking about of the role of a guru also, right? Try to bring it to a more practical, immediate terms in situation in our own life. A guide, a spiritual mentor, a teacher should be a facilitator. So I like to say guru is a facilitator of potential, right? So let's say Maharaj will say your guru is your own potential appearing in front of you. But it's not only, the guru is not just a shower of potential, right? Like, I'm showing you what all that you can be. Good luck. And guru runs away. Guru is as an exhibitor of potential and then a facilitator of potential through example and accompaniment and advice and so on. Like an orchestrator, again, trying to make, as we were talking in, now with this expression, this making these tasteful arrangements to facilitate at any given moment, in any given circumstance, the attainment of our next version of ourselves. So that's why, again, Jogamaya embodied in Krishna Lila is Purnamasi, who is the guru of Krishna Lila. So the notion of guru tattva is very present in connection to this agency that facilitates and accommodates and rearranges the scenario, the circumstances to facilitate a new level of potential to be experienced. So again, I'm saying all that in connection to figures that hopefully we experience in this life, so it doesn't just remain like some abstract personalities in the other world, so to say. But that's the role of Prodamaya in this case. Facilitating, allowing, expanding, stretching, contracting if it's required, the stage of Navadvip, the Gaur Lila for Mahaprabhu to also experience all that needs to be experienced. And there is a lot that needs to be experienced in Gaur Lila. So in the same way that there are prayers to Jogamaya in Vrindavan for gaining entrance in Krishna Lila, and for gaining entrance means to understand what's actually taking place there and to really enter into that reality as an active participant who is willing to contribute. Because Krishna Lila is not just like an ice cream to enjoy, so to say. Right? Like, I want to go there to taste the whole thing. No, you go there to engage in deeply committed service and dedication. You made of yourself a full offering in service to the necessity of the moment in the Lila. So that's the same Gaur Lila, Krishna Lila, Gaur Lila. So again, Prodamaya, Jogamaya embodies or represents this department of orchestration, facilitation, willingness to stretch yourself to make more room, to accommodate more the necessities of love, right? We always talk in this way. Love creates its own necessity. Love is its own necessity in the form of further love, further expressions of love. So how much we are willing to become participants, to play that game, become participants in that game. No, we cannot be passive players in the game of love. We cannot just like be witnesses of the unfolding drama of divine love. It doesn't happen. It's not like a football stadium that you have like VIP seats and you sit there and it's like, oh, okay, that's so nice. Or even if someone would like to make the argument that somehow that's what Santa Rasa is about, like a passive contemplation of the spiritual reality without active participation in it, then at least our Gaudiya Vaishnava argument is that that's why Santa Rasa is not considered among the options of what Mahaprabhu came to give. Not to entirely dismiss that, but to just make the case that's not so much our cup of tea. And that's why Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, when he says what Mahaprabhu came to give, in a broad way, the broadest possible way, still he puts some perimeter and he says Chari Bhav, four types of Bhav. And it's Dasa Sakya Vatsalya Madhurya. Shanta is not included there. Like implying these modes of service in which there's some active participation. So it's a call to engage, ourselves from a committed place to that, right? And again, with nothing against Shantarasa, and that's a whole different conversation, but for me, the point in not mentioning Shantarasa in this particular definition is to make this point, like, we want you to be active participants, because love has lots of necessities, and we need you to tend to the necessities of love in eternity. It's an urgent campaign. Please qualify yourself to become members of this realm. That's how Jogamaya Prodamaya is doing her prachar, her campaign. No? Being very aware of the necessities of love, and she's doing the best she can, but again, and infinite, unlimited souls are required to be enrolled in that play. Now that's an inconceivable play of love, in which there's always need for each one of us. It's not like, oh no, they are self-sufficient. They don't need you, actually. They are just accepting you to do you a favor. But actually, if it were for them, you are not needed there. No? So that will be very strange, right? To feel like, okay, I want to go to a place where actually they don't need me. I mean, not from an ego perspective, no? I want to be needed, I want to be, but just I want to offer a meaningful contribution there. No, if what I can offer is absolutely disposable, then what I'm doing there, right? So it's important to gradually get a glimpse of that, grasp this reality that actually they need you. In the realm of love, you are needed, you are waited for, you are expected, you are required, everyone. It's a personal message sent to each one of us. When Krishna plays the flute, that's basically what everyone hears, what the gopis hear. When Krishna plays the flute in Rasa Lila, the gopis not only hear their own names included in the sound of the flute, they hear that. That's described by the Acharya. So that's a very radically personal call. Your name is in the call. But on top of that, it starts with your name, and then it follows like, I'm dying in separation of you. I need you to be here to tend to the necessities of my heart, to tend to the necessities of love. Please come urgently. End of the message. And of course, we know how the gopis react to that. For someone who is fully aware of the necessities of love, they are more than prepared to run after that and leave all considerations behind. So, but again, that's not just Krishna and the gopis. That's each soul is being called from time immemorial in that same way. Whether we hear the flute call or not, that's another thing. And that's what sadhana is about. We can define sadhana bhakti as training our inner ear, not only to hear the flute call, not only to hear our names included in the flute call, but to hear which is the message that is in that flute call that has our name on it, what we are being called for, what we are being invited to participate in. So that implies a willingness from our side to participate in it. But first, of course, we need to gain an understanding of what we are invited to participate in. The more we understand the nature of that lila, of that play, I will say the more irresistible becomes our response to the call. So all these things connection to Jogamaya and Prodamaya, of course. Because again, it's not that just Jogamaya and Prodamaya is doing everything and nobody else is required, actually. No, no, no. She has her central role to play, again, like a guru. She's seen like a guru in the lila. But the guru is not by himself or by herself. No, disciples are, students are playing their role as well. No? For the guru to be able to be a guru, even if, you know, you cannot say I'm a guru and you have no disciples. That's right. So you need disciples for you to be a guru. And so in the same way, Jogamaya is the guru in the lila, but it's not like, oh, I'm the guru, I'm self-sufficient, I can do anything, everything by myself. No, no. Everyone is required. Everyone, each one of you. And I know maybe in our minds is me required there. Well, Who am I? What can I offer? So the more we put ourselves down by thinking like that, the more we are showing how little we know about who we actually are and all that we can be in terms of potential. Because no, I'm not one, I cannot offer anything. Sorry, but Prodamaya won't agree with that argument. And the idea is that we will be shown all that we can be. Again, that's guru. Figures in our life that confirm, reaffirm all that you can be, give you a proper sense of self acceptance, self confidence on the basis of the self, of who you actually are, all that you can be in love. So we need those healthy mirrors. So we can finally be convinced, actually, I think I have something to offer. Actually, I think my life has a purpose. I can do something with my life and offer that in service in a way that is tasteful, in a way that is required. That's what it is. It's not that it's because I'm so cool and better than everyone else. No need to enter into that competition game. It's just what it is. As the soul happens to be amazing, as Charya Krishna says in the Gita, you are amazing. You are not your own creation, so no reason to be proud of it, but you are amazing. You cannot deny that either. So part of that amazingness is exactly all that you can be and offer in the service of love. You cannot deny that. You didn't create that, so no reasons to be arrogant and proud, but no reasons to deny or cancel that either. Just accept the facts. Not only in theory, but then play out the implications of accepting those fact things in theory, what does it mean in practice, what I'm being invited and called to. So we are all in the journey of gradually awakening to the implications of what it means to be who we are, and what it means for love to be what love is, and what it means for the divine to be the sweet absolute that the divine is, and so on and so forth. It's a gradual process of gaining awareness of the implications, playing out the implications of all that, and living a life, a coherent life, corresponding to all that. So those are my reflections on Prodamaya Kanupriya. So I went to a little, to some other branches of the tree, but still on the same, on the same trunk, basically. I hope that helps. You let me know.
Wow. This was only a curious question, but your answer was, I think what Hari Vyasadeva said in the beginning, may more questions arise. So this became true. Now, I could go on forever. Thank you so much.
That's what we are here for, to have links of eternity, right? I could be doing this forever. But this all happened by the blessing, original blessings of Hari Vyasadeva. That's the
Yes,
only reason
definitely.
here. So you take responsibility, my friend, over there.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Okay, so let's keep this breakthrough room. Always we skip one or the other, because I've seen that John has a question and Avinandana also raised her hand. So we'll honor the order of the list, but oh yes, John is there. So we invite John first, and then we will go to Avinandana.
Hi, Maharaj. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Yeah. You have some
So,
Christmas lights behind you, or is your aura expanding by touching
no,
you?
yeah, that's
Both,
some
both.
lights. We decorated the house. This is the
Nice.
back office, where you've been, of course.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
But
Now I
we have
figure it out.
decorations out in the living room right now.
Nice.
I don't suppose everybody wants a tour, so we'll skip that.
For those who want a guided tour, will you please contact John privately, and he will offer it with great delight,
That
including
sounds good.
the cat,
Yes.
the backyard, the front yard, please. He can even
Yes,
take you on a walk
absolutely.
to the place we went this year with that walking up and down in the nearby
There's
park. Yeah.
Legolas right there.
Okay. A trailer of the guided tour, you have it.
Well, it's good to see you and others here as well. I'm so busy these days, so I'm glad Bhakti Ras sent a message saying that, hey, we're on. So had a chance to get on. Actually, I had a question in my mind that's very, I guess you could say, homely. It has to do with home in terms of preparing food and preparing prasadam. So, I learned, as I think most people did, going through some Gaudiya limb of the tree, that you don't taste anything when you're cooking it. Now, and there's lots of possible reasons for that, but I want to hear some of them. And then I've also heard, it's not devotional philosophy, but just the idea that like eating is a very sensuous experience, and like you should engage your senses in preparing the food. For one thing, you would want to know what it's going to taste like. So like when Kasia is cooking, she wants to taste the sauce to make sure it's going to taste good. For me, I guess I'm a little adventurous, so I just figure, I know I'm going to improvise. Maybe I'll follow the recipe, or maybe I'll improvise a little bit, and I just hope it'll come out good. And the food that we're eating, I'm not always offering it on the altar in front of the deities, but I'm saying some sort of prayer most of the time. Sometimes I'm being very unconscious and I'm just eating it. So I guess why the rule of, don't even taste. It's almost like don't even smell the food as it's being cooked, because that will somehow spoils it for Krishna's enjoyment. But like in Vrindavan, let's say, wouldn't Yashoda Mata want to taste the food a little bit to know that it's going to be prepared well for the family? Isn't the cook at least trying it a little bit to see that it's going to be good enough? So like I understand there's a standard of deity worship that's very much like old school, by the book, old religion. We have to keep things, everything pukka pukka. But then there's also like where that comes from. And if really we're trying to live into the myth, live into the story, I can't imagine, at no point ever did this young mother Yashoda try her own cooking before giving it to her son. You would think that's almost abusive. You could poison the kid accidentally, So yeah, why the hard and fast rules, and when to take them very seriously, and when to say like, no, just be practical. That's it.
Baba Prasad ki jai.
Jai.
We are ready for the meal now. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, those are important questions. And there, as you may imagine, there is no single answer. There is no one way to do it, which I think is an important first thing to say, because many times that's the notion for some, huh? Like, there is this the only possible way to do this. And if you do it, of course, you are in, you are doing it correctly. And if you don't do it like this, you're out. And again, there is a place for that in certain stages of the journey. Then when you advance, and I'm starting to talk more generally besides the food department, but as we grow, we realize, okay, there are many ways to do the same thing. And not necessarily only one is correct and everyone else, any other way is incorrect. Whether it is food, offering, doing kirtan, offering puja, reading a book, chanting, whatever. So many things you can do in life that in the beginning you receive the one and only legal version of it, which again gives a sense of order and security and belonging. Okay, I'm doing it properly. I'm part of it. I'm in it. In the beginning, we may need that, like, clarity. Not certainty, which again, at one point it becomes suffocating, but in the beginning it may become like the initial step to, okay, I'm doing it, I'm part of it, I'm chanting the right way. Of course, it has to be guided in such a way that you don't end up becoming toxically certain and arrogant and see everyone else as inferior. So that's the danger in it. So yeah, prasad cooking offering is not an exception to that. We have this general procedure, as you mentioned. Of course, each one have had their own experiences with that. So for some, oh, John disappeared. Okay, it's being recorded. Oh no, it's there, it's there. Just this course changed in my screen, so I'm finding difficulty. So again, each one of us may have received the training, if you want to use that word, in with stronger words than others. So I think also it's good to always keep things personal, that if someone received a very, how to say, emphatic education about how to do certain thing, doesn't mean that everyone else received that in the same way. So it's important to be open to how others did it. And again, that's part of breaking the box of this is the only way. So I would say that the main spirit regarding do not taste the food, and I always love to reframe the injunctions that begin with do not, with, okay, what's the positive way of saying that? Because if we just stay with the don'ts and we lose sight of the do's, that's negative, really, really negative. So don't taste the food is not so much about don't taste the food. It's more about try to, while you are doing this, try to do it as an offering for Krishna, for the pleasure of God. And in doing that, you become the offering. In doing that, you become... No, try to enter into that space of seeing yourself as the offering, because ultimately it's not even about, as I say many times, it's not even about offering the tomato and the potato and the pineapple. Okay, what's the word in English? Profane matter has become spiritualized after the ritual of offering. I mean, material energy is already in the service of Krishna. Maya Shakti is the highest Vaishnavi, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So I'm not the one who has been offered yet. So the whole idea with this process is that I become the offering. I become prasad. Because if I'm living still a life of separatistic, dualistic exploitation, if that's the case, and it can be on some degree, it's not just black and white, so how do I redirect that energy in a way in which I become the offering? So whatever facilitates that, that's the actual principle. Everything else is a detail around that principle. The principle is make yourself an offering for the pleasure of the divine. How that takes place in shape, externally, it may depending where we are in any given stage of the journey. Going to the point that you ask about tasting what one is cooking before offering or before eating it or whatever. I know Vaishnavas who are very advanced. I know one who has been practicing basically for, I don't know, 70 years. And he tastes what he cooks before offering. But again, the whole thing is not do not taste. The whole thing is why you are tasting, why you are not tasting. That's the actual principle. So if you taste with the intention of, okay, I want to see how this is going for the pleasure of Krishna, for the pleasure of whomever tastes that as an extension of it. Again, that's not a selfish act. It's not like, I want to relish this whole thing from a self-centered perspective only for myself. Basically, that's the principle. Do not foster that self-centered, I am the absolute enjoyer of whatever revolves. We may fall short of that ideal many times, but at least I think it's healthy for us not to deceive ourselves and at least to in principle accept, yeah, it's good to decentralize my false sense of identity. It's good to gradually realize I'm not the absolute center of reality. That's such an exhausting exercise. Try to be the center while you are not. So it's self-compassion. try not to be the center. It's an act of compassion to yourself, because if not, it's such an exhausting act of violence. Try to be the center. You kill yourself basically by doing that. So again, there are very advanced Vaishnavas who will taste that in the context of where they are cooking for the deity, cooking for the guru, cooking for others. Of course, maybe offering everything to Krishna first, but the concern is not self-centered. The concern is in service too. No? So there's place for that. That's basically what I will say. It's just not to over arrange the words. Again, like we will say always, Smartavyasattam Vishnur Vishmarta Vyanajatu Chit Sarve Vidhini Sedasyur Etayore Vakinkara. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. Again, like the ideal. All rules and regulations are kinkara, are servants of these two principles. So, in other words, the spirit of that verse is whatever helps you to enter, get closer and closer to this idea of falling in love with the divine, which is a gradual process, but whatever is favorable for you at any given stage of the journey to get more and more close to that, then that's the rule. That's the principle. For some people, it may be not tasting it. I mean, there's a place for that. There's a place, as you say, to, okay, I'm not tasting it and I'm surrendering to Krishna, that even if I lack some spices or I didn't follow the official recipe, he will fill in the gaps. I surrender to that. So it can be a way in which you are offering yourself in that surrender. So you follow my point? So it's not so much because of don'ts, it's a positive act of surrender and trusting that even if something is missing, he will provide, and I surrender to that. So that's very beautiful. And there is equally beautiful is someone who may have another inspiration to taste it, again, from the place of making sure in service to others, like you gave the example of Yashoda, which, yeah, I will agree that probably she will taste the things for her Gopal. But again, I'm not saying one is better, the other is worse. The important thing is that the act itself, the attitude beyond the act even, is favorable for your particular chapter in the journey. And it may take different shapes. So we have to be very careful, again, not to judge. Oh, you are doing that way. That's not the correct. This is the way. And maybe both are correct, going back to non-dual mentality, right? Someone may be tasting from the right place in their heart. Someone may not be tasting from the right place. And both are equally honoring where they are in the, on the journey and what's most favorable for them, which may not be the same for the other. So that's why we need to go beyond formalities, beyond what's seen on the outside, and investigate what's going on in the inner world of spirit. And only then I can say what's actually taking place. So I don't know if that helps in any way.
Yes, it does help. It does help. Yeah, I mean, you spoke to the point. I was thinking like how a certain standard of discipline might be very beneficial for one person's bhakti and not beneficial at all for another person. It depends on so many factors, how they were raised, how they grew up. If someone's used to being like treated kind of poorly or strictly, like they weren't allowed to do this and that, and now they're kind of reclaiming some of their own autonomy by doing that thing, by tasting the whatever, the pudding. I think I just need to make more space for those differences, both allow that some people need it to be stricter than me, and that's okay, and some people need it to be more lenient than me, and that's okay.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree with what you said at the end, especially, I mean, everything, but the point that you may have your own necessity of how to do certain things, but we have to be careful in us doing, following, embracing some healthy autonomy, not ending up being judgmental on those who may have a different necessity, because if not, our autonomy is promoting judgmentalism, which is the very thing that we were running away from. Okay, I will embrace my own autonomy, so I'm not just following someone else's judgmentally or whatever, but then we can end up doing the same thing. So it's that's the trickiness of it. But yeah, there is a place to do all that again, as long as we do not become judgmental and we are genuinely curious about from which place, not again, not like doing like a surveillance thing, but like being more interested in the inner motivation rather than the. No, there is this nice story in Chaitanya Charitamrita where there is Mahaprabhu and there is Govinda Das. Govinda Das was the personal servant of Sri Chaitanya Dev in his last years in Jagannath Puri, especially in the Gambira. And at one point, Mahaprabhu was like, he had fallen, he was taking like a nap after prasad. So he was sleeping. He falls asleep on the door to his room. Like he was like in between there. So if someone will wanted to enter the room, he will have to walk on top of Mahaprabhu, which generally is not considered like proper Vaishnav etiquette to walk on top of someone, right? Like implying the idea you think you are walking on top of someone. In itself, the expression says it all. So Govinda Das wanted to give massage to Mahaprabhu, as he will do when Mahaprabhu was taking a nap after prasad. But Govinda Das was on the other side of the room, and for him to do the massage that he wanted to give, he would need to be on the other side. But for doing that, he had to walk on top of Mahaprabhu. So he was like, okay, dilemma. But he solved the dilemma very quickly, and he walked on top of Mahaprabhu, and he started to massage him. No? So that in itself makes the point, right? He broke a rule to still honor a deeper rule. No? Because in one sense, not walk on top of someone is more of a formal rule. But if that's for the sake of rendering service to that person, then those rules can be broken. Now, interestingly, after he finished the massage, he had not eaten yet. And there again, there are different ways to take that, but this is to make a point. So he didn't took prasad because he will wait for Mahaprabhu to take prasad and only then he will take. So Mahaprabhu took prasad and he was lying, resting, and Govinda walked on top of him, did the massage, and when he was ready to have prasad, still Mahaprabhu was resting. So he didn't consider walking on top of Mahaprabhu again for him to have prasad for himself. Again, we could say prasad is not for myself, but again, the lila was presented in a way that for the sake of service, the Lord of his life, he was willing to do something that he wouldn't be willing to do for his own sake. Basically, that's the teaching of the lila, right? So I think that's an interesting thing that somehow also depicts what we are talking about here, right? Like, as long as it's in the right spirit, you may be, quote unquote, breaking some rules to follow the deeper rule, the inner spirit of the rule. But if it's for promoting a more self-centered, separate sense of self, then we may sometimes exercise some restraint, so to say, or abiding to some rules. But again, not so much in terms of don'ts, but a healthy restraint to tame the wild beast of self-centeredness. However you may like to put it, right? So, and again, all that will take different forms in each case. So the important thing here is the inner awareness of why I'm doing what I'm doing and not just copy-pasting external formulas. So
Makes me think of, I don't know where the quote, the saying comes from, but I think it's pretty commonly passed around Gaudiya circles that a Vaishnava is very lenient to others, but very strict with themselves.
Yeah, and of course we also have to understand that in a healthy way, right? Because the word strict sometimes have been not the healthiest, has not seen its healthiest application in the community. But yeah, in a healthy way, that's correct. Yeah. Thank you. Great
Thank
gratitude
you.
for the bringing of the offering, and we can go for a few minutes to break through rooms. And explore a little bit further together about this not only related to prasad, of course you can go there if you want, but these sensibilities around following rules and how to honor the inner spirit and how that may take different forms. And again, try to keep it personal, try to relate it to your own personal experiences in this regard, and hopefully, yeah, enrich one another by bearing witness to each other's journey. So, see you in a few minutes for Abhinandana's offering, and with that, we will put our sharing to rest there. So, hoping you had a nourishing discussion. As Krishna mentions, always Dushyanti Charamanti Chabodayanta Parashparam. Beautiful verse in the Gita, which says, yeah, Sadhu Sangha is basically about enlightening, mutual enlightenment, right? Getting together for the purpose of mutual enlightenment, mutual nourishing, mutual pleasure, basically. Brahmanti. So we have nothing against pleasure. And hopefully this, yeah, sharings, intimate sharings, openings of our heart really allow us to taste to experience a higher taste, a higher relish, nourishing, enlightening. So let's go to Abhinandana. She raised her hand. Yeah, she's there. So invited to unmute yourself. Welcome.
Pranam Maharaj, it's so nice to see you after a long time.
Reciprocal, yes.
Maharaj, I was just having a question about mercy and free will. And it's because I'd say my understanding of mercy is very rudimentary, in terms that the first time I came to know that the path of love is totally about mercy was when I read your book, and it was when I had been listening to some others after that. But I mean, it's almost difficult to tell the question that's in my mind. But the thing is, sometimes the things that I hear are like so amazing. And when I talk about that to someone, they are amazed too. But then they're like, why are you into this? I mean, why is it that, not in a negative way, like, oh my God, you're into all of these things. And I'm like, how do you know all of these things? And I'm like, no, someone taught me these things. Like, it's not me. And they're almost like, yeah, but I mean, I think we all have access, but why are you into this? And I'm like, I'm trying to make sense of how, like, I've received certain things. I mean, I can't learn all these things by myself. And there are people who don't have access, or I see that they don't have access to these things, and I don't know how to.
So let's reflect a little bit on, yeah, mercy and agency, free will, grace. Yeah, I think we should begin by saying that divine grace is unconditional. Is offered equally to all. That's example mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada comments on that also. The example of the sun, right? The sun comes and offers its light to all. But still, you have to, if you are living in a cave, you have to do your part. You have to use your free will to leave the cave and contact the sun's light. Now, you cannot blame the sun for not entering your hiding place, right? It's something like that. Because we can sometimes become too demanding in terms of grace. But why grace it work? So grace, of course, extend itself as much as it can, and that's a lot. But it all also invites us simultaneously to do something from our part to respond to the grace. No? Grace is not only what's offered to us, but also grace is the invitation for us to reciprocate to that grace, the willingness to do that. And of course, in the beginning, so to say, beginning, some of us may not be even aware that there's something called grace. And grace by grace, there are different ways. Of course, I'm saying grace, grace, grace. What do we mean by grace? And there are so many ways of speaking about grace. But something that I like to say that recently I heard, and of course, sometimes we say it, grace is, how to say, sometimes we may describe grace in ways that still sound a little bit negative, which is true, and I will give you an example now, but still it may not be the full picture. Like, for example, I can tell you grace is unmerited favor, right? Which is true. But still, it kind of speaks about grace in terms of you did nothing to deserve it. And there's nothing you can do to deserve it, which is true. But still, it's not the full positive way of talking about grace. It's more about how I did not do and I cannot do anything to deserve it. You follow my point? So as much as we can say that, that should be complemented. Complemented? No, that's not the word in English. That should be complementary what we said with a more positive thing. So recently I was listening to a presentation from a Christian theologian, and she said that grace is when someone, and it's a beautiful way of describing grace. We may use this term many times, but we may not immediately attach that as to grace as a definition of it. But basically, it's a simple thing. She said grace is when someone sees you for what you truly are and calls you back to your true self. So that's grace. When someone sees you for what you truly are and calls you back to your own self. So we are no longer here speaking about grace in terms of whether you deserve it or not, which again, we can talk in those terms and say grace is too much to be deserved and so on and so forth. But in a more concrete, positive way, we could say grace is when you are being seen for who you truly are. And by that seeing is inviting us to our true self. So my point with this is many times we cannot just do that ourselves we cannot offer that to ourselves in the beginning. Right? Many times we are the, how to say, in terms of seeing ourselves for who we truly are, we are the worst at that too. I mean, we have the most inaccurate picture of who we are more than anyone else. In terms to in relation to ourselves, in many times. So many times we need first that someone apart from us sees us for who we truly are. Of course, we will say God is already doing that, but again, we may not know about that. We may not have a clue about that. So we need to have an embodied experience in the most in a most more immediate way. Let's put it that way, in more concrete way to our current level of perception. So that may require another entity in this world, so to say, that we interact with. And that person is seeing us for who we truly are, accepting us unconditionally, in a non-judgmental way, receiving us in a whole, wholesome way. And that in itself becomes an invitation to, for us to reclaim our identity. So that's great. Again, it's not that we pay that person to do that. We consciously did something to earn that. It just came as a gift. And once we receive that glance, we can then return the glance to others, but also return that glance to ourselves, whatever that's required. And that will be required a lot. Like, to be honest, on a daily basis, most of us need to return a glance of unconditional self-regard and acceptance to ourselves many times per day to counteract glances that are the opposite of that we throw at ourselves, that are as sharp as deadly arrows, so to say. So we need to balance the equation more and more. So I'm saying all this in the sense that these are gifts that we receive. That many in our conditioned situation, many times we cannot just give that to ourselves spontaneously without having received that first. So that's the principle of grace, a gift that we receive first And only then we can give it to others, give it to ourselves, and so on. Like Thomas Merton will say, if you are praying to God, that doesn't mean that you are taking the initiative in the relationship. If you are praying, it's just responding to God's initial approach to you, always. Because if that wouldn't be the case, then we are speaking about an indifferent God that only will answer the call when you dial the number first. But we don't have even the clue what's the number to dial. We didn't have a clue that there is a telephone, so to say, to call, and there's someone on the other side that will respond the call. So for us to gain an awareness of all that, first we have to receive the call from that person, so to say. So that's there, that's available there always. Again, some people, let's be honest, are not aware of that, and that's why many times we hear how bhakti comes from sadhusanga, in other words, how agents of the divine compassionately, willingly extend that good news, those good news to those who aren't aware of it. No? Extend the light to those who are living in the cave. No, not forcibly taking people outside of the cave, but maybe they would will do they will like just like expertly like do some cracking in the cave. So some ray of light enters and the person like, oh, that was what you were talking about. In other words, I can go into the cave, and we have this cave analogy in Greek tradition and in many places. And if you just know the cave and the darkness of the cave, and I come in and talk to you about the sun, it's like I'm talking Chinese to you. Like, what are you talking about? Sun, light. You don't have a point of reference. So I can talk and talk and talk and talk about the glories of light and its warmth, that you can cook and you can burn and you need so much light and warmth, but makes no sense until and unless I give you an experience of that light. So I may do a little cracking, because if I just tear down the wall of the cave, the light will kill you. It's too much. You are not accustomed to that. So you have to give the person an experience of that, but also an experience that is not killing the person, that is not too much. That's why in our tradition, also one of the apparats or things not to do in regards to the name of Krishna is not to speak about those things to people who have no faith about that. Which for me it's a very interesting thing, because in other words, for me the thing there is, don't try to over talk to others without giving them an actual experience of the thing you are talking about. Because I may not be able to convince you, and to begin with, why I'm trying to convince you, but that's another conversation. But I may not be able to convince you or to provide you an experience by mere talking about something, but I can act in a certain way that provides you an experience of the thing I'm talking about, and that's way more transforming. So that's the actual, as we talk always, prachar. Prachar includes the word achar. It's a very special type of behavior. That's the most effective sharing. You have to behave in a very special way. And not forcibly, but in a natural way, extend compassionate presence, listening, unconditional acceptance, regard. So that's grace. All that's grace. And we can only extend that if we have received that first. So again, all this is grace. These are not products that we can create by ourselves. And many of these ideas, if we want to talk about ideas or concepts we are talking about these days, everyone can go to Google, download the PDF, and get the idea and the concept. But this is a living thing. No? This is breathing, living wisdom. So we can only have an experience of the aliveness of it in connection to someone who is living in that, who is vibrating in that lifestyle. If not, it's just information, data that we can consume, that we can regurgitate and do, repeat, parrot. But for that to be transformative, it has to come from a place, from a transformed place. Like like they say, hurt people, hurt people. So transform people, transform people. You know, if you are willing to be transformed. So again, mercy is there, mercy is available. We are seen and accepted and loved by God, and there are representatives of divine agency all around, but still we have agency and free will. Still we can say no to all of that. Or we can say yes, and there are ways to say yes, and there are ways to say no. There's not just one way to say yes and no. So still we have an agency. And of course that agency will be also informed by previous experiences, by previous samskaras, let's be honest. But still the agent part is there. If free will is absolutely canceled there, then we stop being a jiva, because one of the 21 intrinsic qualities of the soul, as described by Jiva Goswami in Paramatma Sandarbha, is kartritva, which means agency or will. So that's always there. Even if you are very much covert, so to say, by darkness and ignorance, there is always that particle of choice and will that can always be exercised. But of course, for many of us, the best way to do that is in a healthy, proper environment that again facilitates the blooming of our will in its most perfect way. So that's grace. Satsanga is grace. Having you all here today is grace. So thank you for gracing my and our existence with your presence. Hope that helps, Abhinandana. What do you think? Any other thoughts?
Yes, Maharaj. Thank you so much. I think the example you gave of, what you were talking about, how prayer is not your what something that you're initiating. I never thought about it that way. And many other things. Thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Yeah, I think that's a big part of the reversal that needs to take place in practice, that gradually many of the things we thought we initiated, then we realize actually this is in response to something that was already initiated by someone else that is not me. Gradually we have to gain that awareness and how the sweet absolute is the ultimate kickstarter, so to say. And we are not to downplay ourselves, but just to put things into context, and we are just returning the embrace. And of course, again, when we do so, he's so humble and grateful and taking our approaches, we are the kickstarters in his humility. And then there's a further reciprocation and then back and forth. So both sides are equally humbled and moved by each other in love. That's what it happens in love to both parties, both God and the soul. So let's go to one final, a little slightly shorter breakthrough room before we meet one more time to say goodbye till the next weekend, for a few more minutes to share with between each other about some personal experience in connection to what we have been sharing so far today in terms of grace, free will, how that has knocked on your door. Did you dare to open the door? What happened after that? Where are you now in relation to all that? So Bhaktiras will invite us to breakthrough rooms, which are designed for us to have a breakthrough. Maybe a breaking down and breaking open before that. Maybe a precondition, but breakthrough as well. So see you there and see you in a few minutes. Okay, welcome back. Hoping you had a nourishing sharing again. And yeah, we put the sharing to rest today with your permission. I'm very glad to be back after a few weeks. It has been so long since I haven't been absent for that long. So you were really missed. So happy to relish, as we relish separation, union, separation, relish union proper. And looking forward to continue relishing it for the coming months without interruption. So yeah, looking forward to meet you next week, which will be the same time as today, since I'll be still in New Zealand. So still we have to adjust a little bit the timings according to the local time zone, and then we'll return to the usual timings when I'm back in the US. So deep gratitude for your presence. Sri Satchinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai. श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, समवेद भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि बोल।